Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Wall Street Journal bestselling writer Matthew Fitzsimmons, author of the new novel Constance. Matthew, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Sure. Well, if someone hasn't yet heard about your new novel, Constance, how would you describe the novel?
Well, it's a little bit of, it's been an interesting one trying to describe, to pick a lane for it. Literature, the industry loves to have a lane. You're a this, you're a romance novelist, you're a fantasy novelist, you're a this novelist. And I have traditionally been a mystery thriller writer. I wrote a 5-book series, the Gibson Vaughn series, for anyone who's read it, that was sort of a traditional mystery thriller arrangement story. And Constance is a little bit of a departure, if you think about it in those terms. It is a science fiction mystery thriller that takes place just a few years in the future. It's set in Washington, D.C. In the late 2030s, 2040, and it is about a young woman who is navigating a world where human cloning is becoming a reality, that it's a new nascent technology. And essentially, if you wanted to distill the book down, it's a book about a woman who has to solve her own murder to save her own life. It's a story of a clone who is investigating the death of her original, the person upon whom she is based.
That's a great premise. Do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to writing Constance?
I do. I remember it very clearly. It was one of those sit up in bed eureka moments. I like to play a game with myself where I try to take a familiar conceit or idea and see if I can spin it in an original direction. Sometimes I can, sometimes I can't, but I like the exercise of, like, how could I take the bank heist and turn it on its head? Or how could you take a rescue story and change it in some way that I hadn't seen before? And I basically posed the question to myself, how could someone be put in a position to be both detective and victim? How could someone have to play both roles and investigate their own murder? And I sort of spent the whole evening sort of thinking about it and trying to think of examples where it had been done before. There's an old 50s movie called DOA, which was remade in the 80s with Dennis Quaid, about a university professor who's poisoned and he's dying and he has to find out what happened to him. And then there's a movie called Crank, which is a little bit the same, where someone has been injected with something and is dying. And then there's some supernatural stories where ghosts come back looking for answers and sort of try and get someone to. So there's a supernatural thrust there. There are a couple of different attempts to it, but I hadn't seen anything exactly like this, because how could you? How could you be dead and still investigating your own murder? Well, what if you're a clone? And it was sort of like 12:30 at night, and I was lying in bed and I was falling asleep, and I literally did one of those Hollywood movies, sit up straight in bed, eureka things. And I ran to my keyboard, and it was a Thursday night, and I stayed up all night, writing notes, world building. And I wound up writing the first chapter, which is now chapter 4. And then I put it back in a drawer and I didn't touch it again for a couple of years, because I was sort of in the thick of the Gibson Vaughn books. But kept pulling it out, kept noodling with it, and was a little bit afraid of it, because, again, it's sort of like, once you're one kind of writer, it's very difficult to say, oh, I want to now do something slightly different. That can be very confounding to your publisher, who has finally figured out how to market you, and now you're like, no, but now I want to do this, market me a new way. But they were very supportive of it, and they liked the idea, and I'm very excited to write this finally, after 5 years of thinking about it, to see it, come out and let people react to it and see what they think.
That's great. So what was it about cloning and the idea of cloning that intrigued you?
Well, once, once I had the idea, once I went, well, cloning will allow me to do this ridiculous story idea. Once I was wedded to it as a, this solves my, solves the question of how can I contrive to tell this kind of story? Then I started, you know, then I started actually like reading about cloning and trying to look at the technologies that were involved with the way that I was going to present cloning. And you know, one of the ideas that is necessary to it is the idea of consciousness upload. So in my book, you know, the cloning is basically used as an insurance policy. So if if Jeff Rutherford was accidentally killed, the company that did the cloning would have a copy of his consciousness and a clone of his standing by. They would download the consciousness into the clone, and Jeff could carry on his merry way with a minimum of disruption. And that was the concept behind it. And you know, getting one of the fun things about being a thriller writer is people who are experts on subjects are always so happy to talk to you and sort of share their expertise. So I wound up talking to, you know, they are starting to map human consciousness. The idea of consciousness upload, while it does not exist, is something that is starting to be explored, and what the necessary mechanics of that would look like. And of course, cloning is fascinating because we already do human cloning in this country. We do it every single day. In stem cell research in laboratories, human cells are cloned. What we don't do is bring a human, we don't clone a human and bring it to a viable birth. That's sort of the line that we've drawn. So it's, but there are no federal laws against it, interestingly. The states have various laws on it. There are states that outlaw human cloning, and there are states that don't in 2021. But there are no federal laws governing it. So it seems to be just sort of a gentleman's agreement that we won't do it, but there's not actually anything to prevent it happening. So once I had that as a basis, it was really fun to think about how, if you introduce this cloning, this idea of cloning, human cloning, how would America react, or how would the world react to something that was so foreign, something so transformative and potentially scary? Like, how would we as a culture and as a society and as a legal entity react to someone going ahead and doing it? So it was just a really fun concept to sort of play what if,
sure,
to build a world where it existed.
And I'm curious, what was your initial writing journey that led you to writing and getting your debut novel published?
Well, that's, I like to joke that I was an overnight success 25 years in the making.
Well, tell us about those 25 years.
So, I wrote a novel in my 20s. I spent 4 years working on it. It was a literary novel. It was as a lot of first novels are, it was a brooding, somewhat autobiographical story. I sort of put everything else on hold. I waited tables. I basically was the starving artist. And by the time I got done with it, I didn't like it very much. Possibly because I don't think it was very good. Plus, I had spent a good portion of my 20s working on it while the people I went to college with had gotten graduate degrees and were getting married and were buying houses, and I was waiting tables. And you sort of, you know, when you try to go the arts route, there can come this moment where you're like, okay, I have made a terrible mistake. I took my shot and I missed. You know, the people who go out to Hollywood at 20 and try and be actors, and they spend 10 years doing it, and then it doesn't happen. And what do? Do you keep chasing the dream, or do you get a job and try and make up for lost time? And it can be a real crisis of consciousness. And just existential, like, what am I doing with my life? Mm-hmm. And I spent a few years working in sort of the tech sector, because it seemed like a way to make some money. And I didn't really like that very much. And then in my early 30s, I took a job teaching high school English. And I spent 12 years as a 12th grade high school English teacher. And I stopped writing. I didn't write anymore. I didn't like writing. I didn't talk about it because it was, frankly, it just felt embarrassing. Like when you try and do something, if you spend 4 years writing a novel, at some point people are sort of like, are you really working on a novel? Or you just say you're working on a novel and you're just sort of, messing around. And it was kind of miraculous teaching English and reading books and talking about books every day. Slowly I got the bug back. And I started writing again, and I didn't talk about it. I didn't tell anyone I was writing again. It was it was just for me. And I was almost embarrassed to be doing it again at first. I was like, I don't want anyone to know, because they'll be like, oh, come on, Matt, don't go down that rabbit hole again. And then I guess in 2012, so I guess 9 years ago, now, golly, I started writing my first, what eventually became my first published novel, which was The Short Drop. And I spent sort of 2 years working on it largely in secret. And then I showed it to some friends and I said, would you read this, as a published book? And there were people that I knew wouldn't lie to me or wouldn't tell me what I wanted to hear, or would tell me the painful truth. And they're like, this is good. Finish this. And I did, and at the ripe old age of 43, 44, I got an agent, and he is a wonderful fellow named David Hale Smith, and he got me a book deal that enabled me to stop teaching and to write full time. And Short Drop came out, and I was very fortunate that it did well, and I've been writing full time ever since, and this is my sixth book. So it was this sort of amazing, I was sort of down to my last strike. I had tried to make my dream happen a number of times, and this was sort of my last chance, or what felt like my last chance.
Sure.
I got very lucky.
You mentioned this initial idea where you sat up in bed, where you were thinking about Constance, and you said you sat up most of the night making notes and you were working on other novels, so you didn't write it immediately. When you came back to it, what is your writing process, and is it similar from book to book? Do you do a lot of plotting before you sit down and write the first word or the first chapter?
So it's been changing. I don't know how it is for you, but I do this thing after every book where I sort of sit down and I do like an after action report where I say, all right, what worked well here? What worked badly here? What can you improve? What should change? When I started writing Short Drop, I literally just sat down and started writing. I had no idea where it was going. I didn't know what it was about. I just started it. And I was 30,000 words in before I even figured out what my main character was about and what he was doing. And frankly, actually, the whole story changed. Like I was doing a story about a guy who has a terminal disease and he gets basically approached to do a suicide mission. And that was the idea for the story. And at some point I was like, I don't want it to be a suicide mission. I literally dropped the idea that got me started on it just fell away. And it became a much more interesting book after that. And gradually over time, I think I'm more of an outliner now than I was. I treat it like a job. I get up in the morning Whenever I, I'm usually up by 6, and I try to be in the chair by 6:30. And for a while, I would work from 6:30 until 5 or 6 every day. And 6 to 6 or 7 days a week. And it was years, but I didn't take a vacation for years. Like, I felt this, like, now you have this thing, don't ever stop. And a book or two ago, I sort of did my after action report. I was like, you're killing yourself. Your writing's getting worse. You're pushing too hard. And your overall quality is dropping because you are mentally exhausted. And now I get up at 6:30 in the morning and I work until noon. And I have a word count in mind. And if I hit it, I'm done. And if I'm not, I keep going. And if I am, I'm done for the day. And I'll go back and I'll edit, or I'll do some, other work, and I make sure to get some. I also wasn't getting any exercise for a while there. And I was like, nope, got to keep that in.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
And you sort of get under deadline and you're like, well, I guess nothing, I don't have to do anything else. I can eat whatever I want. I don't have to exercise. All I have to do is get the book to deadline. And one of the things I learned is that you got to take care of yourself. Like, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And so I think I'm gradually finding better balance about it, and I'm less like manic to be always working. Does that make any sense to you?
Yes, it does. It does. I'm curious, outside of the exercising and cutting your day short, were there other techniques that you used to deal with kind of the mental exhaustion?
I take weekends off. That's a lie. That's a flat out lie. That's not true. I try to take weekends off. I have taken vacations. I have gone away from writing altogether. Just said, okay, I'm not going to write this week. And I'm going to take a trip. And that was really hard for me. Like, a lot of my vacations were like, I would just go somewhere else and work there. And that would be my vacation. I'm like, I'm going to go somewhere scenic and sit and work. And that's not really, that's not recharging the batteries, although that's nice. And that's really nice to be able to do. And I still like those kinds of trips too. But like, just saying, I'm not even going to take my computer with me. I'm just going to go somewhere and like have a vacation and like unplug and not think about the book or writing for a couple of days. It makes a huge difference. You come back, I come back, I'm excited. I've got new ideas and I've sort of refound my energy, if that makes any sense.
Sure. Are you working on another novel now?
I am. I am unexpectedly writing a companion novel to Constance called Chance, which takes place about 2 years after the events in Constance, and which had not been the plan at all. When I was writing Constance, it was really going to be a standalone book, and that was going to be it. And then at some point, my publisher had seen a draft of Constance and said, "Oh, you know, we'd really like another one of these." And I went, "Well, that's great. I don't have another one of those." And they're like, "Oh, that's too bad." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm sorry, but like that was what we agreed." And a day or two later, I took a shower. And by the time I got out of the shower, I had a second book. Like it just sort of came to me in a, "Well, what if this?" And I called them up. I was like, "Change of plan. I have a second book." And they're like, "What are you talking about? You said you didn't have one." I said, "Well, I took a shower." Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Colombian author, was famous for, I sort of took a lesson from him. I think every writer's got their own tricks, but his was, he had about four extra hot water heaters installed in his house in Bogota. And he didn't get out of the shower in the morning until he knew what he was writing for the day. And sometimes that meant being in the shower for a long, long time. And I've always felt a certain kinship with the man, because I also find the hot shower to be a very conducive figure out your next move.
That's
space.
That's great. Well, what writing advice would you offer for those who are working on their own stories and novels?
So, I mean, one of the pieces of advice that one piece of advice I give is, you know, disregard all advice, because there is an awful lot of it. And one thing that writers who have already been published love to do is to give advice. And by and large, you know, their writing is you need to figure it out. What works for you. That said, I think it's useful to hear what other writers mm-hmm. do, and understand that that's only necessarily right for them. Like, I dare anyone to try and write the way Stephen King writes. I mean, the man writes 11 books a year. You know, there's nothing he can tell me that's going to make me as prolific as he is. I'm just not that guy. So his advice is not necessarily going to fit my model. But I will give my English 12 advice, which is one of the ways that I sort of figured out how I was going to write was that, you know, so one of the pieces of advice that's sort of common, and which I think is an excellent piece of advice, is people say, well, you need to read all the time. You need to read everything you can hand on. Read lots of authors. Read, 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 read. And I think that is true. 100% read a lot. But And here's my counter to that. So the people say read broadly, but I would also say to read narrowly. And what I mean by that is, one of the interesting things about being a 12th grade English teacher is that there were certain books that I taught for 8 years, 8, 9 years, every year. And that meant that I would reread the book prior to beginning it. And then I would read it as the kids were reading it. So if I said read chapters 1 and 2 for Wednesday, I would read chapters 1 and 2 for Wednesday. And what that meant was there were certain books that I wound up reading 50 times. And I think I chose pretty good books. So I was reading books by, you know, phenomenal. You know, I read Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison 50 times. And it's the interesting thing. You take your favorite musician, your favorite band, and their favorite album. You've probably listened to that album 100 times, 500 times over the course of 20 years. And every time, you know, and you get to know that music intimately and in a way that I don't think you even realize it. You know it note for note, you know, when the key changes are, you know that song by, you know it so, so well. The interesting thing about books is an author, Kazuo Ishiguro, takes 5 or 6 years to write a book. We read a Kazuo Ishiguro book in 2 or 3 weeks, depending on how fast you read. and we put it down and we never look at it again. And we think that we got it, that we understand what this Nobel Prize winning author did. And what I would tell a writer is, you didn't. You didn't begin to see really what that writer, what that phenomenal author did, what Toni Morrison did, or what Kazuo Ishiguro did, or whomever you want to name. And so what I would say is, if you come across a book that you love, that you think, wow, how did that book have this effect on me, that I keep thinking about it, consider reading it again, and then reading it again, and reading passages of it over and over. And you will learn things from it and techniques from it that you just will not, it's not possible to see on a first reading. It's just not possible. That's my advice.
That's great. Well, what novels have you read recently that you enjoyed?
So I just read Kazuo Ishiguro. I'm literally looking at it right now. I read Clara and the Sun, which I Kazuo Ishiguro for me is just an appointment novelist. When his new book comes out, I have to stop and read it. I mean, I think he actually wrote a book about clones, Never Let Me Go, which I think is still for me the best. It's interesting. You're starting to see this interesting like blending of genre. You know that for a long, Kazuo Ishiguro has, with his last few books, he wrote a book about human cloning. He wrote kind of a fantasy novel, and he wrote Clara and the Sun is about a robot girl, and they're all literary fiction novels. And there's suddenly this interest and acceptance in authors using science fiction and fantasy, which has always been sort of cast off to the side as a sort of like niche genre thing that is separate from, quote unquote, serious fiction. And now all of a sudden you're seeing this wonderful, I don't know whether you want to call it discarding of those strict labels. So I read that, and that was pretty terrific. And then I read, I read Andy Weir's last one, Project Hail Mary, which was a lot of fun. And I'm just about to start Razorblade Tears by S.H. Cosby, which is supposed to be a phenomenal book. I'm very excited about it.
That's great. Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your new novel, Constance?
Well, my website is very creatively www.matthewfitzsimmons.com. I'm on Twitter more than I should be. I'm on Instagram, except I'm terrible at it. And those are probably the three best places to spot me. I'm trying to get better at the Instagram, but it is not my natural. It's not my natural medium. But I'm doing
sure.
My best.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Matthew Fitzsimmons, author of the new novel Constance. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Matthew, thanks for doing this interview.
Jeff, thanks so much for having me on. It was great.
Now, for a brief excerpt from the audiobook of Constance by Matthew Fitzsimmons, narrated by January Lavoie, available from Brilliance Audio, wherever audiobooks are sold.
Brilliance Audio presents Constance by Matthew Fitzsimmons, performed by January Lavoie. The little purple Christmas tree had a lot to answer for. Con hadn't celebrated Christmas in the 3 years she'd lived in Washington, D.C. Hadn't meant to this year either. But then, on the way home from the corner store, she noticed the tree in a box of junk left on the sidewalk outside her building. She couldn't say what made her rescue it, but it felt right playing Charlie Brown in her very own melancholy Christmas special. She took it up to her apartment and set it on a table, where it twinkled at her hopefully. Other than being 2 feet tall and purple and not smelling a bit of pine, the little tree was virtually indistinguishable from the real thing. But it put her in an uncharacteristically festive mood, and she poured herself into decorating. She even baked Gamma Jal's fruitcake, which sat untouched on the kitchen counter, but made the apartment smell like home back in Texas. However, her spirits, like the tree, proved artificial. Celebrating the holidays alone was like setting a bonfire in her living room, one that cast unwelcome light into all the dark, carefully disregarded recesses of her life. The delicate truce she'd recently established with her depression unraveled overnight, and she woke on Christmas morning feeling low as hell. She worked remotely for a small nonprofit, which made it far too easy to avoid human contact if she chose. But how had it been a week since she'd left the apartment for anything other than food? Einstein should have spent more time investigating the uneven way that time passed in December, the supermassive black hole of the Gregorian calendar. Perhaps that was why she accepted the invitation to the dinner that night, an orphan potluck for people with no way to get home for the holidays. Not that she would have set foot in Lanesboro even if she could afford the ticket. She hadn't been home in close to 5 years, not since the beginning of her sophomore year in college, when Mary Darcy, her mother and righteous servant of God, had informed Con that she was going straight to hell. Con had looked her mother dead in the eye, and with 19 years of pent-up fury, answered that she'd meet her there. They hadn't spoken since, not even after the accident. The party started well enough, but a table full of lonesome people and their press-on good cheer only reminded Con of how isolated she'd become. She compensated by accepting an invitation to go home with a burly white New Zealander. His name was Oliver, which he pronounced in a way she found delightful. Oliver had thighs like Doric columns, a mane of curly black hair, and a laugh that made you want in on the joke. She had no intention of actually going home with him. These days, it felt better to be wanted than to be had. But she enjoyed the confidence of his attention. To a point. After dessert, she extricated herself from the table to the living room and fell into a conversation with a musician who Con discovered shared her Mick Ronson obsession. And like that, Oliver and his tragic thighs were forgotten. How many people even knew the name Mick Ronson anymore? Much less could hold a knowledgeable, geeked-out conversation about his guitar work on early Bowie albums like Aladdin Sane and Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. It was like discovering a shared, secret language, and the two women huddled in a corner for the rest of the night, talking guitars and exchanging songs and tidbits of musical lore. Somehow Con never knew that Ronson had played guitar on John Mellencamp's Jack and Diane. That blew her mind a little. For the first time in a long while, she wished she'd thought to bring her guitar. At an uncharitable hour the next morning, the bleeding of the alarm woke her. Groping around on the bedside table, she found her LFD and slipped it behind her ear to find out why. Today, December 26th, 2038, will be sunny and clear, with highs in the mid-90s. Another scorcher. The eighth consecutive day and far from a record for late December in Washington, D.C. A calendar notification reminded her about her appointment at Palingenesis.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.